The rest of you, if you'd be so kind, if you would, either in body or spirit, if you'd please stand with me as God's people stood at the foot of a mountain. So too, we don't stand at the foot of an actual mountain. We do stand at the foot of his word, and we just like to recognize that by standing together, beginning in verse 9. We're going to read all the way until we get to verse 20, and it goes this way. What shall we conclude then? Do we have any advantage? No, not at all. If we have already made the claim, the charge, that Jews and non-Jews alike, they're all under the same power, the power of sin. As it is written, and he begins quoting from the Hebrew Scriptures, there is no one righteous, not even one. There's nobody who understands. There is nobody who seeks God. All have turned away. They have together become worthless, and there is no one who does good, not even one. Their throats are open graves, their tongues practice deceit, the poison of vipers is on their lips, their mouths are full of cursing and bitterness, their feet are swift to shed blood, violent. Ruin and misery, they guide them, mark their ways. And the way of shalom, the way of peace, they don't know. There is no fear of God. There is no, in other words, awe, recognition of someone above, no worship before their eyes. Now, we know that whatever God's ways say, it says to everyone who's under the law, so that every mouth may be silenced and the entire world held accountable to God. Therefore, no one will be declared right before God, righteous in God's sight by what they do, by the works of the law. Rather, through it, one of the things that we learn, through that law, we become aware, we become conscious of our sin, that we have all fallen short of the glory of God. These are the staggering words of God. You may be seated. Our culture, in different ways, especially the West, sort of a list of ways that our culture has done this, but has tried to find a way to divide up the good and the bad, or the good and the evil. And we all try to do that, right? If you've been a parent or a child, how many of you have ever been a child before? Okay. There's a sort of fitting way in which we try to understand that from like an elementary way. Okay, this is good, this is bad. But more deeply, our culture has done this maybe slightly different throughout the years. If we go all the way back to like one Mr. Plato, his attempt was to divide up the world this way, the physical realm, the material realm, bad. Right? In the realm of pure ideas, the realm of pure truth, the realms of pure form, good. Right? So that and talk about somebody living in their head. But you can still see the implications of this today in debates around gender dysphoria. You can see it in debates around even eating disorders. You can even see it in the ways in which we attempt to upload or achieve immortality as human beings by uploading our lives into the digital realm, right? So digital, good, right? That's pure and it's for, and the material, bad. Even the ways just observe life, living our lives, good in the realm of the digital world, bad, say, the material. So you see nuances of this still today carry out. Lines have been drawn in other ways, right? Lines have been drawn rationality, logic, reason, good, imagination, emotions, or the ways in which we experience the natural world, bad. In the case of Descartes, reason, logic, good. In the case of the Romantics, the exact opposite, imagination. Our experience in life, those things are the more, where life is to be found. So it gets flip-flopped with the Romantics, and it gets flip-flopped if you, you know, trust logic and reason, and you see that play out, right? The implication of that, science always good, faith always bad, or vice versa, faith good, science bad. You see these dynamics play out in those ways. Lines have been drawn socially. Famously, Marx, he said, you know, the proletariat, the working class, that's the revolutionary class. And the bourgeois community, those who own the goods and the production of goods, they need to be overthrown despite their contributions to human history, despite their contributions to, you know, human progress. Every single political ideology tries to do the same thing. tries to divide up the good and the bad in this way. Assumes salvation is to be found by being freed from this side and putting your trust over on this side, if you will. But these ways of drawing up these lines between the good and the bad, they tend to work by creating hostility. They tend to work by locating where the evil and bad is only on one side of the world, or one side of the political aisle, or in those people, if you will, or in that in sort of ideology. In politics, evil's always found, or the bad's always found out outside of your view. So I always tell people, you know, the reason you hold the views you hold is because, well, you think those are the right ones, right? Those are the good ones, and everybody who thinks differently, well, they hold the bad views, and this comic sort of expresses that. We're the good, and they are always the bad. This is sort of the eternal mantra. So if you're on the right side of the aisle, it's the lefty Lucys who are the bad, the evil, the no good. If you're a lefty Lucy, it's those, you know, righty tighties. They're the bad, and they're the evil. That's where bad and evil is to be located. If you're a person of color, it's the white folk, and if you're a white folk, it's persons of color, or perhaps immigrants who are ruining my America, right? This is where the bad and the evil is to be found. Christianity, however, frames things altogether differently. Biblically speaking, the line between good and evil cannot be ever drawn between us and them. And I mean that in both ways, either us being all the bad or us being all the good. You see this sometimes, even when people talk about like colonization. Well, the colonizers were all bad, or they're either all good. And this is the way in which we divide up the world in this way. But in the Bible, that line isn't running through or between us and them, but it runs down the heart, famously, right? Down the heart of us and them. And thus, and them and us. And the question is why? Why, according to this story, is that the case? Well, we touched on it last week when we said, well, because every human being has fallen short of the glory of God. Or as G.K. Chesterton once quipped, he said, Christianity isn't the gathering up, I'm paraphrasing, but Christianity isn't the gathering up of all the good people, right? I often sensed that when I was young. There's a bit of like, what is this? When you watch how the Christian community operates, and I understand, like, as a parent trying to protect kids and things, but like there's this sense when you're young, there's like, oh, I think this group of people is trying to gather up all the good people, all the happy people, all the shiny people, all of the sort of, what I would say, how would you call it? Not just shiny, happy people, but the blameless people in this way. But he says Christianity isn't the gathering up of all the good, happy, squeaky clean people and keeping out the bad, sort of frightening, alien people. And he said, for the simple reason is that there aren't any good, shiny, happy, squeaky clean people. And according to this story, not even one. There's all people have fallen short of the glory of God. Bonhoeffer put it this way, and we're looking at his cell, and he has this book, a collection of, you know, his letters and prayers that he writes there. He goes, the thing that we despise the most in the other isn't wholly absent from us. And I think about this a lot, partly because I've done a lot of reading of him. But if I can think of one group that we could all agree on, and I'm going to take a survey. This could be a bit of a risk and could carry out some conversations later. How many of you think that the Nazis represent that which was evil and bad? Okay, so for those who didn't raise their hand, maybe your elder can talk to you about it. But, and he wasn't saying they weren't bad or evil. He says, the very thing that we despise in those people, and he was put in prison by Nazis, isn't entirely absent from us. I find that stunning that he ever said that, given that he's put in this place. If there's one person who can, if there's one group of people, we can certainly them, it's got to be the Nazis. And he said, no, that thing that you hate in them, what they are capable of, that too can be found in each and every one of us. This message is pointed to through and through the scriptures, right, in the quote-unquote heroes of the Bible. Abraham, a coward, betrays his wife. Moses, functioning like a megalomaniac pastor or a megalomaniac megachurch pastor when he thinks that he can stand in the place of God and take on that position, like, I'm going to function for them as if God, and then he strikes that rock, and that one act disallows him from ever entering into the promised land. You have David, who didn't just have an urge one afternoon, but uses his power to get what he wants from a woman, essentially assaults her, because who's going to say no to the one who holds all of the power in that kingdom? He was a king. Nobody says no to the king, so he assaults that woman. We find out in the New Testament, Peter is in patience. And then we find out from Paul himself, he calls himself the goats. And you're like, the goats? Yeah, the greatest of all time sinners. Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am the goats. I am the greatest of all time sinner. What is, except for one, right? What's the one exception to that? Now, maybe when you hear that list of failures, moral failures, we're like, well, I've never really done that, so that exception must be me. No, there's only one exception to that, and that would be the person of Jesus and nobody else. So what on earth is going on in Christianity? What other religion does that? What other system does that? What other group of politicians have you ever heard do something like this? Now, I don't mean like rag on somebody that was, you know, given a particular position of power and didn't carry through on what he promised or she promised to do. I'm saying, what other group of politicians would ever speak of their Mount Rushmore of leaders and be like, yeah, they were utter failures in these particular ways, and then tell you how they failed? And that's precisely what this story does. What other system points to its greatest leaders and like, yeah, they failed miserably in a culture where I am sorry and I am wrong is almost nearly impossible to hear? And I don't just mean amongst gaslighting politicians. I mean in our workplaces, even amongst our own friends, in our own homes maybe, within our own marriages perhaps, where that's almost nearly impossible to hear in our culture. The Bible, yet again and again, walks us down this gallery of all sorts of failures. Heroes that lie. Heroes that steal. Heroes that assault. Heroes that abuse. Heroes that murder. Heroes that hate. Heroes that basically find 1,001 ways to not love God with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength, which usually follows they don't love their neighbor as their self. That is almost so unique to this story and so rare outside of it, we might even call it uniquely and distinctively a kind of biblical understanding of things. But saying that doesn't come without some real challenges, and it doesn't come without real questions and perhaps some important ones, especially amongst those who desire to protect the weak or protect those who are vulnerable or the poor. There have to be some people, we say. There's got to be some people who are more victims than they are sinners. There has to be some people in the world who are more, sinned against than ever sin themselves. And doesn't this idea that there's not even one person who is good, and I mean that all the way down, doesn't that seem to victim shame? And doesn't that seem to enable those who continue to abuse and to assault? And my simple answer to that is no. On the one hand, yes, the Bible speaks this way repeatedly, more than once, that none of us could ever stand before God and be like, yeah, God, you kind of deserve me. Like, I deserve something from you because of my life. So the Bible's clear on that message. But it's also clear in the fact that it rages against the oppressors. We could spend the rest of this afternoon, and I won't, but we could spend the rest of this afternoon with hundreds of passages that speak against injustice and speak against oppressors and speak about it this way. I'll just share one. The Lord works righteousness and justice, and those words are deeply connected for all of the oppressed. This word is very, clear about the oppressor and what they deserve. So how do we hold these two things together? On the one hand, there's only one pure victim. And on the one hand, in this world, there's only one real oppressor and one true liberator, and none of those are us. The only true, real victim to have ever walked on this earth is Christ. And the only unredeemable oppressor is Satan. And the only true liberator is our Father. It's God. And second, in this story, innocence is never required to be protected. Purity is never required. It's not a requirement to gain the protection of God. And this is the case, you see this in the garden, right? It's not like Adam and Eve are protected or clothed and given eternal promises because they are innocent victims of the snake. And this is the case with Cain, right? Cain kills his brother and God protects him, not because he's innocent. And this is the case in Deuteronomy 7. God says, I didn't choose you as a people because you were great. So it's not like he takes them out of slavery because he thinks those people are innocent, and yet he protects the victims in this way. At the heart of Christianity is an understanding of real victimhood, and that real victimhood is the cross. The cross was Rome's way of silencing victims, to make victims go away and to make them nothing. Now, ironically, I think that symbol ends up being the very thing that they tried to use to get rid of victims ends up being the most, you know, well-recognized symbol of the Roman Empire. But it's the cross. It's the cross where God identifies with every single victim. And I don't mean thoughts and prayers, thoughts and prayer. I mean by his wounds we have been healed. He doesn't just sort of sympathize with them. By his actions he places himself, God, amongst the nameless. And amongst every victim, named or remembered or, not remembered. And not just giving voice to them either, like joining in with them and also speaking up even in Jesus' ministry against those who oppressed in the first place in this way. But that's not all. If we want to do more than just remember victims, he died in solidarity with all of us. That includes, by the way, the executioner. That includes the bystander, and that includes the victim, obviously. But even more, let's say you walk this earth saying, I'm not a victim. And maybe you even have been oppressed, experienced abuse or something like that. You're like, don't treat me like a victim. Even those who say, I'm not a victim in this world, we still, because he died in solidarity with every single one of them, cannot ignore those being oppressed. We cannot ignore their plight, just like we cannot twist their suffering in sort of self-justifying ways, which immediately pulls the rug under all the twisted ideologies that you find on the left, on the right, and on center, which justify the suffering of victims. Here's why. A Christian view of victimhood never puts the unbearable weight of innocence and purity on the victim. A Christian view of victimhood always calls out for the protection of, always seeks to protect the victim while also pressing justice on the oppressor. Here's how this kind of plays out in the real world. You'll find both sides do it. They twist the suffering of victims. I'll give you an example on the left. This is just recent stuff, so it's easy to maybe get our minds around. You heard it right after October 7 in the attacks. When the rape of women, the killing of babies, and the murder of innocent civilians having a good time, right? You heard immediately after that, well, they shouldn't have been oppressing Palestinians for years. In other words, the burden of purity and innocence is on those who live amongst those who have been, right, oppressing Palestinians for years, rather than saying, no, that's wrong. On live TV, people said this. You'll see it on the right. I've heard it over and over and over again. The thousands of women and children who have been killed, blown up by bombs, entire infrastructure, and you've heard it on live TV, people will say things like, well, they shouldn't harbor terrorists amongst them. As if their innocence or purity. No, both sides, I don't care where the victims are, on either side, a Christian understanding of victimhood says, no, that's wrong, period. It's not something to stand for. They need to be protected, and so forth. The political left and right, in my mind, simplify the complexity. How might what do you think the response of the right is to the fall of Adam and Eve in the garden? How do the right-wing folks, and I'm being facetious, but I think the truth still stands. How would a right sort of leaning person respond to Genesis 3? The shrug of his shoulders. Should have made a better choice. Should have been adults. They made their bed. They have to sleep with the consequences. It's their sin, it's not my sin. Next time, they should make a better choice. They should have personal responsibility, make better choices like I do. How does the left respond to the fall? How would a left-leaning person respond to the fall of Adam and Eve? They would rail against the injustice of the whole situation. They would rail against, you know, the fact that, you know, poor Eve, she's a victim of this manipulative snake. Not only that, they would rail against the garden itself as a system. Who put the tree in the center of the garden in the first place? In the Bible, sin doesn't get reduced in this way. It's reductionistic. It doesn't boil down either in the Bible to personal responsibility or the system alone. Adam and Eve are responsible individuals for what they have done. And what that does is give them dignity, it gives them individuality, it gives them agency, it gives them accountability, and all of those things. But in this Bible, they're also given hope. They're clothed with the redeeming promises of God. They're neither or. They're not solely victims in that scene, but nor are they solely, say, adults who should make better choices and should know better next time. They are both. They are responsible individuals who made a terrible decision, and yet God holds his redemption out to them and his restoration and his promises. And in many ways, this story shows how kind of, I would argue, how we've over-spiritualized the struggles that we see all around us. If you listen closely, you'll hear the ways in which the struggles, whatever those struggles are, they could be in the Middle East, they could be for the heart of America, the way in which the struggle has been sort of brought to another level of like existential weight, where every claim that you hear for justice or struggle or for the heart of America, they tend to use the language of last battle. They tend to take on that kind of level of severity or weight, where the good is all gathered up on one side and the bad is all to be located on another side. But here's the thing, there's not one struggle that can take on that kind of weight. There's not one fight that can take that level of existential weight of last battle on this side of Jesus, whether it be for the purity of the church, whether it be for the heart of America, whether it be for the Middle East, that can take on that level of existential weight and not turn into tyranny, and not turn into totalitarianism, where all the bad is over there and all the good is over here, all the bad is over here and the good is all over there. It's always the path that leads towards tyranny, legitimizing any means necessary. Because once your side is all good and that side is all bad, you can do whatever you want because it's for a noble cause. It is for something that is true. It is for the good because the good is all over here and the bad is all over there. It's the logic behind lots of things. It was the logic behind the battle hymn of the Republic as the northern troops started to go north as they began to sing, "My eyes have seen the glory of the Lord," to send a message to southern troops. It was the logic of the French, the terror that was the French Revolution, where 17,000 people lost their heads, not to mention the bystanders who weren't deemed radical enough. It's the logic of the Chinese Cultural Revolution when educated folks started to call into question the killing fields of Cambodia, all in the name of cultural progress. It was the logic of many of the oppressions that were done by Christian nations, Catholic or Protestant, as they pursued a more, let's just say, a properly Christian nation. And it's the logic you hear in the Middle East. You hear it on both sides. You hear it when people and sympathizers with, obviously, the Palestinian people, when people chant from the river to the sea, the eradication of the Jewish people from the land, but you hear it on the other side as well, when any means necessary. Doesn't matter, in many ways, the collateral damage. When one side seeks full justice on this side of Jesus' return, which is impossible. In this story, the logic of dividing up the world in this way will always fall flat on its face. Why? Because there are no good, shiny, squeaky clean people. Not even one. Well, except one, but we already talked about him. The line that divides, famously, that good and evil, it cuts down the heart of every nation. It cuts down the heart of every political party. It cuts down the heart of every class, rich and poor alike. It cuts down the heart of every person of color, every white person. It cuts down the heart of you and me. Would you please pray with me? Our Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, God, we bless your name. You alone are the God who created all of this, and the God who redeemed and is going to restore all of it as well. We praise your name. God, we often ask you to come into our lives, to even take them over, to search the secrets of our hearts, the unknown parts of ourselves. But the truth is, we don't really want that. What we really want to say is, don't reveal, don't make us aware of who we actually are, because we think we're better off when you leave us to our own illusions, our own devices. So God, we seek your mercy, because without that truth, without your view of us, that awareness, without you, we die, because we don't know even where to run or who to run to or what to do. So God, save us. Save us from the pleasantness, which too often is just another name for our ambitions. Save us from the temptation to say to another what we think they want to hear, rather than what we both need to hear. God, the healing that comes only by living your truth is hard. But help us to remember that any love but truthful love is cursed. The lie wrapped in love is just another word for violence. For God's sake, for the world's sake, give us the courage and the love to speak truthfully. First, to hear it from you and your word, so that we might be at peace with one another and with you. We pray this in Jesus' name, and all of God's people say,